From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Despite a constant stream of financial news available these days, our guest today says within families, there's an epidemic of silence about money. We're talking this hour with Ron Lieber. He's personal finance columnist for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. Lieber says many parents would rather talk with their children about the birds and the bees than dollars and cents. But with this book, Lieber's hoping that will change, that families will start to have these conversations, and the benefits, he argues, will go far beyond the individual kid or family. Lieber says society at large is better off when its members are more savvy about money. Today in The Exchange, Ron Lieber is with us, and let's hear from you. What fundamentals did you learn about money growing up, and what didn't you learn? And if you're a parent, what questions do you get from your kids about money? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Ron Lieber joins us from The New York Times. And Ron, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So why this epidemic of silence?
I think parents keep money talk and money information to themselves for a variety of reasons. But one of the biggest reasons is shame. And shame comes in all forms. People are ashamed of having more money than average. Maybe they're ashamed that they inherited it and they did not earn it. Maybe they're ashamed because of the way that they earned it. Maybe they're ashamed because they have less than average. Maybe they are ashamed because they are out of work or because they don't earn as much as other people in their community. Maybe they're shame about lack of knowledge of money, and maybe they're shame about the fact that they don't like the way, or they're not proud of the way that they spend their money, and they're afraid of their kids finding them out.
Wow. So we're so uncomfortable and conflicted about this ourselves that we just keep our mouths shut.
I think that's right. I mean, shame comes in all forms, and it afflicts people of all, you know, ages, shapes, sizes, races, and social classes. But for people who have kind of gotten over their shame, there's also one other hurdle that people often have to clear. Even if they have no shame about money and have a thorough understanding of it, they often feel like that the best route when it comes to money and children is to protect their kids from all of these money conversations, to keep them in a bubble just a little bit longer, to shield them from adult worries and anxiety, or the possibility that they will size one another up and their friends up and other people in the community according to who has what. And this is all very lovely, and I understand the natural instinct to do it, but I also think it's naive. See money out in the community. They have questions about it. Money is a source of great power and mystery, so it's only natural that they will have questions, and us shutting them down and quote-unquote protecting them is not going to satisfy that curiosity. And so I actually think that the best way to protect kids is to arm them with information that they need to become adults, and this information is part of what they need.
Well, so you write, among the comfortable, that parents are afraid it'll create money-grubbing kids, as you put it. What about among the less comfortable, Ron? I'm wondering if parents who, you know, are a little on the edge financially don't want their kids to feel like, you know, lie in bed at night worrying about being homeless.
I think you're probably kidding yourselves if you think that your child is not aware in at least some sense of what is going on with your family. It is very hard to keep your own anxiety in check. Kids are going to overhear conversations. They are going to understand innately from the earliest ages that they don't have the same things or go to the same places as some of their friends do. They know this. And if you aren't talking about it, or if you're shutting down their conversations or their questions about it, there's a pretty good chance that it's actually going to make them more anxious, because they know that there is this information that is true and that their parents are hiding it from them or are actually lying. And there's a way to explain it to them that doesn't cause anxiety, that maybe even relieve some of the anxiety that caused them to ask in the first place.
Right, right. Well, and I love what you write that, you know, parents get over this fear about talking about money. You say talking about it isn't just a chance to say, here's what we make, or here's what we can afford, or here's what we can't afford. It's a chance to talk about all sorts of values, really important human values. Give us a little bit more there, Ron, please.
Well, sure. If you are a middle-class family, or if you happen to have more than average, you are in the fortunate situation of being able to actually make decisions about what your kids do and do not have. And there may be many instances where there are things that they want that you could probably afford or afford some of that you don't actually want them to have or you don't want them to have right now. And that conversation, that context, that circumstance, that's about values more than it is about money. Because saving money and waiting, that's about patience and delayed gratification. And spending, your spending decisions, that's about modesty and it's about thrift and it's about prudence and spending money on the things that are going to make you happiest. And when you think about giving or when you ask your kids to set aside some of their allowance to give or when you talk to your kids about the giving that you do, that's about generosity and gratitude. These are all things that we want to imprint upon our kids. We don't usually think about money as being a way to teach it, but in fact, all of these money conversations, all of the questions that kids ask about money can and should lead directly to conversations that can last for years about what it is that your family actually stands for.
Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our guest for the hour is Ron Lieber. He's personal finance columnist for the New York Times. His new book is called The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. One more time, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Something else that struck me about this book, Ron, you say it's always been important for families to have these conversations. The kids see right through us when we're not talking to them about it. But you say in this book that it's even more important now. How come?
Well, the biggest thing that's changed from when I was a kid is that we have 16 and 17-year-olds facing down college, and all of a sudden, it is a six-figure decision. It is insane, right? For the 4 years, or more likely five, it takes kids to get through UNH, through the, you know, the flagship state university, you may well end up spending $100,000 on room and board and tuition and all of the extras if you don't qualify for any financial aid. The fact that we have 16 and 17-year-olds leading the discussion and the decision about these things, let alone whether to spend, you know, $250,000 to, you know, go to Bentley or Bates, is madness, right? You know, these kids have almost no training in money or financial decisions, and then all of a sudden, they're deciding whether or not to take on $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 or $60,000 in student loan debt. And again, remember, they are teenagers.
Yeah.
They're making these huge decisions and they're batting their eyes and, you know, weepily begging their parents to go to the private school instead of the public school. And they are not ready. They have no context. We have not done enough to teach them, to get them ready for that big decision. It is probably the biggest financial decision of their lives, and they are making it with no experience or training. It is lunacy. And the biggest reason I wrote this book was because I realized that we needed to take a decade before that big decision and start getting them ready.
Well, and there's a couple other reasons why you say it's important, especially now. But let's stick with this college cost and debt issue for a moment. And as you might know, Ron, New Hampshire college graduates have the highest debt burdens in the nation. But I'm interested in what you said. Teenagers, you know, 17-year-olds, are leading the discussion, even though they have very little financial savvy. Are they leading the discussion?
I do think they are. I think in many instances, parents just have not been able to save enough or save anything at all. You know, if they're saving money for retirement the way everybody, including me and the New York Times, tells them to, there's not going to be that much left over for college savings, too, particularly if you're in a situation where, you know, your income has hiccuped or been interrupted by what's gone on in the economy. Maybe you've had a health scare or a health problem that's caused you to have to save a bunch of money, or a special needs kid, or who knows what else has happened in your family. It is just hard to save any extra money at all, let alone enough to, you know, be able to write a check. And so what ends up happening is that, you know, the kids are going to have to fund a pretty good part of this, whether it's through debt or whether it's through work study, or, you know, or by taking a year or two off, taking a gap year to work for a while, or by joining the armed forces and, you know, accessing the GI Bill. You know, kids are playing a big financial role, but it's also the case that, you know, when they look at us, you know, with their big eyes, then, you know, they beg us to let them, you know, go straight to UNH and not go to community college, or beg them to let us, you know, let them go to, you know, Bates and Babson instead of UNH, you know, at a cost of an extra $100,000.
Wow.
It's very hard to say no. These are our kids. We want to give them everything that we possibly can. And quite often we end up making foolish financial decisions in that moment without really realizing just how big the consequences are going to be for everyone. So even if we think we are leading emotionally, quite often we are not.
Wow, that's what you found, huh? After talking to all these families.
I think that it's absolutely the case. I mean, and just, you know, think about being in that situation. You know that it's a crucial turning point. It's a big pivot point for your kid. It's so important that they go to the right place and get the right education and meet the right people. And, you know, we absolutely think about this, you know, in terms of snobbery. It's hard not to, you know, which label, you know, on the diploma is going to make the biggest difference for my kid. Where are the highest quality professors and peers going to be? And it's hard not to tilt towards more expensive, because we've just come to believe that more expensive equals higher quality. The fact is that it isn't always true, but it's also the case that it's very, very difficult to tell the difference, and it's very difficult emotionally to say no to a child who wants a college education that's more expensive, and claims at least that they are willing to take on the debt to do it.
All right. Well, after a short break, I'm going to ask you a couple other things, Ron, including other reasons why you say it's even more important now than ever for kids to understand money. For example, you say pensions and healthcare used to be provided by employers. Now the shift is more to the employee. You talk about social media pressures and so forth. So we'll talk about all that in just a moment. You can join us to 1-800-892-6477. Ron Lieber's the guest, personal finance columnist for the New York Times. And we'll be back after a short break. We're going to check in now with our short March fund drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, New York Times personal finance columnist Ron Lieber is with us on his new book, The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. And Ron, before we go to our listeners, before the break, you were talking about how, yes, it's always been important for families to have these conversations, even more important than ever. You were talking about the high cost of college, the college debt issue. But another issue you write about is that as our kids get into the workforce, more and more and more, they're going to have to fund their own pensions and their own healthcare. So there's more pull from that daily salary than perhaps a generation or two ago.
It's true. One way to think about this is as the fact that we parents are in the adult-making business. And what adults have to do from ever earlier ages is handle the fact that the world has heaped additional amounts and ever-increasing amounts of risk and responsibility on them. So now you have to pay for your health insurance or pay a penalty. You have to get it. It's no longer optional. You can't go bare unless you want to pay a fine. Same thing's true with retirement. There are, you know, a few places, some government employees, for instance, that continue to earn towards pensions. But you can't be sure at 22 or 23 that you're going to stick with a job for 40 years. And you can't be sure that you won't get bounced from that job. So, you know, you've got to be saving for retirement yourself. And all of this is to say that there is a need now for increased readiness for these kids at 22, 23, 24 to come out into the world and be ready not to make big financial mistakes. There's an increasing necessity, really, to win your 20s financially, because if you don't start saving or getting it together until you're in your 30s, it's going to be that much harder to save enough so that you're able to retire one day. All of this is to suggest that it is us, the parents, who need to get them ready. It isn't going to happen in school. It isn't going to happen in college. It's going to happen because we have helped teach them good habits, and that needs to start when they are kids.
Well, and you talk about social media pressure, too, with kids. Another reason to have the conversation, because they see things shared and they say, well, why didn't we go to Florida? Or why can't we, you know, go to a Red Sox game, which is extremely expensive? You know, you talk about that as well, Ron.
It's true. You know, I think about Instagram in this context in particular. I mean, sure, kids are seeing things as they've always seen them in the hallways of their school building. And some kids have more and some kids have less. And, you know, that's always been on display. It always will be. The sociologists describe this as a dignity gauntlet that they run each day.
Wow.
Where they are sort of keeping track of who has what and other people are keeping score of them. But all of this is amplified nowadays by social media, particularly Instagram, which teenagers love. It's literally, you know, an engine for envy, where everybody is sort of putting forth the best version of themselves. It's a sales tool in disguise. Here is my awesome shopping trip, and here is my awesome job, and here is my awesome house, and here is my awesome family, and here is my awesome family vacation, and you didn't get to go on a vacation like this, and here are my awesome friends, and you thought that they were your friends, but actually they're with me right now, and we're doing something that you weren't invited to. And oh, by the way, I expect you to like it, to hit the thumbs up button as you have your nose pressed against the iPad glass. I want you to like it. And it becomes competitive. So this is what our kids are up against, literally, when they have their noses pressed against the iPad glass. And I just think it's important for us to be cognizant of that. This is more pernicious than any form of commercial television that has ever existed. Which is not to say that
gauntlet.
We should ban it, but we should watch it.
Yeah, well, you can't ban it, right? The horse is out of the barn, so to speak. But a dignity gauntlet, that's pretty powerful language.
Yeah, those are the words of Allison Pugh, who's a sociologist at the University of Virginia. You know, she wrote basically an ethnography of a couple different schools in the East Bay, east of San Francisco, many years ago. And what she observed is that each and every day, you know, kids are walking this gauntlet, literally, where they go to school and there are constantly these conversations about who got to do what and who got to see what and who got to have what and who has what with them on their body or on their person or in their room or in their basement at home, and who doesn't. And, you know, it's not that we can or even that we necessarily want to shield them from this, but we should be aware that, you know, this is happening. And it's actually good to wait. It's good to yearn. These are all good things. And, you know, not every kid, in fact, no kid should have everything they want or anything close to it. But this is hard, and it's particularly hard for kids to navigate. And, you know, we should acknowledge it. We should name it, and we should talk to them about their feelings about it and talk to them about why we make the financial decisions that we make, including what jobs we have, which may dictate what we earn, or what we do with the money that we do have, so that they understand when they do run that gauntlet why it is that we've made the decisions to provide them with some things but not let them have others.
All right, let's go to our listeners, Ron, and then I have a lot more questions for you, including the thorny allowance question. So I'll put that out there and we'll talk about that in a moment. The phone number for you to join us on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And Melissa joins us from Concord. Hi, Melissa. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. So I had a pretty comfortable middle-class New Hampshire upbringing. And during the occasional times of financial stress that my parents experienced, I think they hid it from me pretty well. So by and large, I was protected from their financial stresses. Recently, I had the opportunity to participate in a simulation activity that was designed to help policymakers and social service providers gain a better understanding of the daily juggling of financial concerns experienced by people in and on the edge of poverty. So each family had a different situation, different incomes, assets, and I was assigned the role of a child in a financially struggling family. What I was struck by was the incredible amount of stress that I felt as a child in that role play as my family tried to figure out how to stretch its limited dollars to pay both recurring bills and unforeseen expenses.
Well, like what kind of stress, Melissa? Like I'm going to be on the street, or I wish I had that nice vacation that Johnny had, or what?
I think it was more concern for the struggle that my parents in that role play experienced. So as I was asked for $2 to get on the bus for a school field trip or to buy Valentine's cards to give out to the whole class,
right?
I was really concerned by what I heard and experienced as my family tried to juggle those bills.
Yeah, Melissa, thanks for calling in. You know, she's right, Ron. There are all sorts of little incidentals that we're asked to contribute that for most of us is, you know, sure, here's $7 for the field trip or $10 for the pizza party. But for some families, that's a pinch, and it's tricky.
It is tricky. And there are actually ways to give kids who are comfortable the same simulated experience that Melissa had. She may have been playing an online game, so to speak, or simulation called Spent. If your listeners Google Spent game or Spent simulation, they should be able to find it. I've done it with my 8-year-old daughter, where we walk through a month's worth of decisions, and things happen to you and things happen to your family, and you have to decide whether you go into debt, whether you decide to delay the car repair, whether you get your teeth fixed when you're living paycheck to paycheck. It's incredibly powerful, you know, for kids who are lucky enough to have what they need, I think, to begin to understand what it might be like if they did not. And so, you know, these sort of simulations can be useful. But I think it also speaks to the fact that it's very hard to shield kids from this reality. It sounds like Melissa was lucky enough in her comfortable middle class existence to be shielded from the occasional hiccups. But I think, you know, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, or if worse, you know, you simply do not have enough each month, it's just very difficult to hide that from kids. And it is stressful.
Let's go to Bedford next, where Pam is on the line. Hi, Pam. You're on The Exchange. Good morning.
Good morning. So I didn't have a question, but I just wanted to kind of share a story. I'm a single mom, and their father has been a very solid contributor to my kids' financial upbringing. I recently, because of tuitions and things like, you know, getting teeth fixed and house repairs that were not expected, went into credit card debt. And rather than hide that from my kids, I shared with them the challenges and the choices I had to make and how being in credit card debt is actually a really slippery slope. And I shared that with them because I felt that it's important for them to understand why doing such a thing, getting into credit card debt, is something to be avoided at all costs. So it just, you know, it was challenging, and I think it created some anxiety, particularly for my daughter. But I felt like it was an important thing to do. I guess, you know, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Sure. Yeah, Ron, thanks for calling. Excuse me, Melissa. Pam, thank you for calling in. And, you know, you talk, Ron, actually, in the book about the credit card statement as a great learning tool.
Yes, but what I did not do in the book, and I should have, and it now occurs to me hearing from Pam about this, is that you should talk to them about debt, too. And, Pam, I would actually love to follow up on your story if you contact me through ronlieber.com. I'd actually like to hear more about it, because I think this is especially important. A 10-year-old at one of my very first talks after the book came out raised his hand and talked about the loan sharking that was going on his playground at school. And everybody laughed, but I actually thought he seized on something really important in that moment, because kids need to know what debt feels like, because literally 70% of them that go to college end up in debt, and they have no idea what that feels like or what it's going to feel like in their 20s. So hats off to Pam for being honest. I understand that it may have created a little bit of anxiety in her daughter, but I think she can rest assured that the experience of knowing what that feels like and working your way out of it with your parent in a transparent way will cement for her some really important values and feelings. So Pam, please reach out to me at ronlieber.com. I'd actually like to hear a little bit more about that.
And actually, Ron, I haven't mentioned yet that you will be in New Hampshire at the end of the month. Ron will be at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on March 30th. And we've got more information on our website, nhpr.org, on that appearance. Loan sharking on the playground? I have to ask you about that.
Yeah, so that's another one I need to follow up with. Young Joseph from Brooklyn goes to a public school there, and he told me that, you know, the kids are lending one another money each day or each week, and, you know, charging interest. And, you know, I think it's small sums. I I'm not sure where the impetus came from, but I thought it was fascinating. But it also made me think that while loan sharking may not be, you know, the best way to teach kids about debt, and getting yourselves into debt and then, you know, working your way out of it in front of your kids maybe isn't ideal either. We need a way for kids to understand what debt feels like. We need a way to train them in that so that they're better able to make the right decisions about getting in the right amount of debt when they go to school. Because, you know, I'm fully aware that it's very hard to go, you know, even to a state university without student loan debt for many students, but that they have just enough debt, but not too much and not the wrong kind of it. And I'm, you know, actively seeking kind of the best training mechanism for that, particularly with teenagers.
Should parents, Ron, tell kids how much money they make?
Yes, they should, but not until the kids are ready. And it takes a decade, I think, to get them ready, right? So, you know, you start with the allowance, and at the same time, they're learning math, you know, between the ages of 6 and 10, you know, ever larger numbers, beginning to understand how to work with numbers that are 2 and then 3 and then 4 and then 5 or even 6 digits. In the meantime, they're spending their own money, single-digit amounts, double-digit amounts. Maybe they're saving for an item that costs, you know, into the hundreds, right? And then between 10 and 14, you start telling them about your own budget, about the things that you spend in the household. And maybe then you're getting into four-figure amounts. And then once they're in high school, you want to make sure that they have the right level of discretion. That's what most parents are worried about. They don't want their kids to blab about what the money, what the family has or what the family does with their money. And so you want to make sure that they are protecting their friends' private information, their siblings' private information, your own private information that you have already shared with them. And then and only then at 16 or 17 or 18 do you sit down with them and say, you know what? You deserve to have this information. In fact, I think you are entitled to it because it's only fair that as you begin to make very important financial decisions about what you are going to invest or borrow to get your college education, that you know exactly what it takes and what it took for us to give you whatever life you have at the moment.
And Ron,
so you don't have that
off,
information. Yeah. How are you supposed to make those decisions?
I'm going to cut you off there, but after a break, I do want to ask you about one dad in your book who explain this in a great way. So we'll talk about that after a short break. We're going to check in, though, now with our short March fund drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, New York Times columnist Ron Lieber on his new book, The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Smart About Money. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. By the way, Ron Lieber will be presenting his book at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on March 30th. So if you want more information about that event, go to our website at nhpr.org. And Ron, just before the break, we were talking about whether parents should tell kids how much money they make. And you said, yes, absolutely, but not until they're ready, not until they're in their mid-teens and starting to think about college. There's an example in the book that I love about a dad who got this question from his kids and said, yep, I'm going to tell you how much I make, and I'm going to show you where the money goes. Tell us about that, Ron.
Sure. So here's what he did. He went to Wells Fargo and he asked for his entire monthly paycheck in cash. And not just in cash, but in singles.
$1 bills.
It turned out they didn't have enough singles. So he had to come back the next day or the day after. And he left with one of those old-fashioned canvas bags and it was just filled with stacks of money. I think he earned about $100,000 a year at the time. And back he went to his home and he took the money and he dumped it out on the kitchen table, no announcement, no ceremony. He just dumped it there.
$12,000, roughly, right? Or $10,000, whatever.
Yeah, the kids came running, and they were incredibly excited. And then he proceeded to start peeling it off. And he explained that this is what goes for the mortgage, and this is the electric bill, and this is the water, and this is Little League, and this is Cub Scouts, and this is our weekly pizza night, and this is ballet. And this is the car, and this is the other car, and this is the gas for the car. And on it went. And pretty soon there was very little money left on the table. You know, they have a bunch of kids in that family. There were maybe six or seven kids. And, you know, earned a very healthy income. But it turned out that that $100,000 did not go a long way because they did spend, a fair bit of money on the kids and their activities. It was a really useful thing for the kids, the older ones in particular, to see where it all went. And the dad did it in part because his parents had never shared any of that with him, and it was a source of great frustration to him as he got to be a teenager and then a college student that he did not know what it was that it was going to take to have the same kind of life that he had grown accustomed to.
So it was a source of anxiety not knowing.
I think it is a source of anxiety not knowing. I mean, let's not forget, right, that kids, 3-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 16-year-olds, it is their job, first and foremost, to figure out how the world works and how to navigate in it and within it. And money moves a lot of people. It causes a lot of problems. It creates a lot of opportunities. But it is part and parcel of, you know, more or less every object we encounter, every experience we have. Money lies at the root of almost all of it. And as much as we don't want to think about the world in that way, it makes us feel maybe a little bit icky or a little bit too much like we're, you know, creating little capitalists. The fact of the matter is that it's true. We cannot change it unless we go live on a commune. And so far better to get kids used to that idea and start training them than to do the opposite and attempt to shield them from it, which is not to say we're trying to create money-grubbing kids or kids with a, you know, fetish about money. We just want to make it more of a focus, the same way we teach them about art and writing and reading. This is just something else that's in that category of stuff that we should teach.
Here's a great email from Liz in Holderness. She says, when you're talking to your kids about money, you can help their future adult selves talk to potential long-term partners or spouses about money. Liz says, looking back on my own 13-year relationship, I see that values and assumptions around money have colored everything from early dinner dates to joint gift-giving, vacations, home buying, home improvement, and so on. Liz says, even if it's difficult to talk to kids about money, think of it as preparing them not only to handle money, but to be the kind of adult able to articulate their values honestly, and to commit to a long-term relationship with eyes open. Liz says, I wish more young people about to embark on the lifelong commitment of marriage felt able to discuss money and money-related values before saying I do. Ron, it's interesting. You know, she's absolutely right. Family money conversations aren't just about parents and kids. It's in between parents if there are two in the house.
Oh, my gosh. I want to marry Liz. Actually, I have a wife who I love deeply. But in another life, maybe I would have married Liz. Yes, she's right. She's hit it right on the nose. And, you know, the more progressive spiritual leaders in our world, pastors, rabbis, priests, all of the above, they make this part of the premarital counseling. They actually ask the couples who come to them to talk with one another about this, to ask themselves some important questions, to have searching and often searing conversations about what happened in their own households while growing up and how that affected their feelings about money and the values that fall out of that. And it's such important work to do before you commit to someone for a long period of time. And so few people do it. And, you know, what I've heard again and again since the book came came out, is that parents, when there are two parents in the household, are often having conversations after reading the book that they have never had before. To me, that is a high compliment as an author. And if you are a single parent, it's just as important to get your own head screwed on straight before you try and screw your kids' heads on straight when it comes to money. And, you know, ask yourself some deep questions about what it is that you really feel about this topic. How much is enough? How much is too much? And, you know, if you are worried that you're not going to be honest with yourself, talk to a sibling or a close friend who is also a parent or who is just, you know, not going to believe you when it sounds like you're lying to yourself, and have them push you really hard to make sure that, you know, you've got a philosophy and a strategy for this too, because it's important.
Well, and it reminds me, Ron, of a story at the end of the book. I got a chuckle out of this. You interviewed a set of parents from the Chicago area about their values around money, how they transmit those values to their kids. And you asked them some very, you know, good probing questions, and you got blank stares. And this is where I laughed out loud. They finally admitted to you what many parents feel. They said, you know, Ron, we're just kind of winging it. give us a little bit more on that insight, that at least they were honest that when it comes to this topic, a lot of us are kind of winging it.
Yeah, that was a really important moment for me because, you know, I'd actually gone to see them. That wasn't the only family I was visiting in Chicago, but, you know, I'd gotten on an airplane from New York City to go hang out with them. And they'd sold their big house and downsized to a smaller house, and they gave a bunch of the money away, and the kids were involved in that. And I thought, wow, this is one of the most awesome and awesomely transparent and awesomely generous things ever. This is going to be a part of the book. I'm so excited to meet these people. They're going to have so much to teach the rest of us about the kind of overarching philosophy and strategy that went into this. And there was no overarching strategy. There was no philosophy. They were young parents just trying to figure it out. And, you know, and then here comes like Dr. Money from the New York Times trying to overlay all of this mumbo jumbo on them. And they were like, huh? And, you know, I realized that, you know, most of us, you know, are kind of making it up as we go along. And, you know, maybe we shouldn't, right? Maybe we should have a few kind of first principles in place before we start. And that's why I wrote the book. But it was just funny that these people that I was trying to sort of, you know, lionize or raise up into archetypes were looking me all confusedly when I tried to ascribe to them, you know, these sort of heroic qualities of parenting that they didn't even actually realize that they possessed.
Yeah, I found it very refreshing, actually. I found myself liking those folks. But, you know, you mentioned you're trying to give us a couple basic principles in the book around these conversations, around some of the values that we have about money and transmitting those to our kids. There are tons of great stories in this book and different strategies and different stories from different families about saving, charity, thoughtful spending, splurging. But there's a lot in here, Ron. I mean, what do you do first? I found myself when I was done with the book going, okay, this is great, but I don't even know where to get started.
Sure, you can get started by just committing to talk with your kids more about money. And one way to do it is by giving them some. We've actually gotten through most of the hour here without talking about allowance, which
I
is
know.
Sort of miraculous, yeah. Right? Because, you know, parents kind of wig out about, you know, what the right amount is and when to start. And let me just sort of short circuit that and say, it's really not all that important. What's most important is that you do it. I think you should divide it into three jars: save, spend, give. Those jars are actually stand-ins for these values that add up to the opposite of spoil that we talked about earlier. And then, you know, engage kids. You know, they should put at least a dollar a week into each of the jars, but you can really divide it however you want. Whatever your family stands for, that's fine. But, you know, make sure to have a conversation with them, you know, at least once a month about what they're saving for, what they want to spend on. Any ideas this month that are different from last month about who you might want to give it to? And then as you go through your own life, narrate. Because the beauty of those three jars that I put on the front of the book and that I think your kids should have in their rooms is that that's what adults do too. You know, we spend whatever it is we spend. Hopefully we're able to save, you know, 10 or 20% of what we make. And then we give some away too to people who have less than we do. So we're doing the same thing. And we should just talk to them as we're doing it about the decisions that we're making, the trade-offs that we're making especially. Talk more.
All right.
And that'll help a lot.
Ron, enjoy your talk in Portsmouth at the end of the month. Again, NHPR.org is where more information is about Ron's talk at the Music Hall. Thank you so much for being with us this hour, Ron. We really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.